You're listening to the Mushroom Revival Podcast.
Welcome to our show, listeners. This is an educational podcast that dives deep into all things fungal. And this episode is excellent to start out with if you are mushroom curious and you don't know where to begin. My name is Lyra Niemackel, one of your hosts.
And my name is Alex Dorr, the other host.
We're so excited to have you here. Fungi are everywhere. They are interface organisms in almost every sense.
They are decomposers, digesting some of the toughest materials from plastic to oil spills to radioactive isotopes. And with that, they're also recomposers.
They are soil makers and mushroom makers.
They can make a pasta dish taste way better or have you process 10 years of childhood trauma in 5 hours.
They are aquatic and terrestrial.
They can kill you, or they can nurture you.
They are both micro and macro.
Somewhere between plant and animal, but maybe a bit closer to alien.
Ephemeral and everlasting.
Ancient and futuristic.
And while they are everywhere, they tend to go mostly unseen.
They are the humble stewards of our global ecosystem.
Fungi is a kingdom of life. This includes yeasts and molds and mushrooms, truffles, lichens. And it wasn't until 1969 that this kingdom of life got their taxonomic independence. So prior to this date, they were considered to be lower plants.
But they totally outnumber plants by 6 to 1. There's so many species of fungi out there in the fungal kingdom, and we barely scratch the surface of discovering even a fraction of them. We've only discovered about 120,000 species of fungi, and there's estimated to be 2.2 to 3.8 million species that have gone undescribed or undiscovered. The tip of the iceberg.
We have so much to learn about this kingdom of life. And the first way that we can really understand what they're doing here is to understand their roles in the ecosystem. The roles that a fungus has is primarily defined by how it gets its nutrition. There are multiple ways that fungi interact with the environment around them to obtain nutrients and further replicate.
Now, it depends on who you talk to on how they like to categorize fungi. And fungi are they're such rebels that they don't like to be categorized, and they kind of do their own thing. But to put them into two camps of ecosystem roles, I like to put them in decomposers and mutualistic or symbiotic. So the first camp, decomposers, a lot of people think of parasitic fungi. So either fungi that attack or grow on other mushrooms or other fungi, or they attack animals like us. We have candida or dandruff, or there's cordyceps, that they're mushrooms that pop out of insects' heads. There's a lot of parasitic fungi that attack animals, but there's also a lot of parasitic fungi that attack plants. If you've ever taken a mycology course at a university, they always talk about pathogenic fungi. A really common example would be the famous Irish potato blight, which was caused by a fungal infection. Another really famous example is the largest organism on planet Earth, also commonly referred to as the honey fungus. And this is 2,384 acres of mycelium, of the roots of this mushroom growing and decomposing trees in the Pacific Northwest. And it's funny, here in the United States, we don't use the metric system, and for distances, we always use random random things to equate distance, the number of washing machines, or in this case, the number of football fields. So the equivalent of 1,665 football fields. The other kind of subcategory of decomposers are those saprophytic fungi. And that's a fancy word of saying fungi that eat dead or decaying matter. And so when a tree falls in the forest and no one's around to hear it, fungi eat it up. And they're responsible for turning all the leaf litter, all the dead trees that fall into rich soil. And they're actually responsible for storing up to 70% of carbon in our soils. Now, those are the decomposers. Now we move on to the mutualistic fungi or symbiotic fungi. So the first subcategory is mycorrhizal or endophytic fungi, which have a beneficial relationship with plants. And so mycorrhizal fungi have this connection with up to 95% of terrestrial plants, and they connect with the roots of plants, and they help trade nutrients and protect the plants and help trade and send signals to other plants. They're really amazing for also storing carbon and for the life of plants on our planet. And endophytic fungi are just fungi that live in the leaves and the stems and inside the cell walls of plants. Another similar species would be lichen, which is a relationship with cyanobacteria or algae and fungi. And you probably see them on park benches or rocks or in the barks of trees. It's kind of this frilly web-like structure, and it's sometimes green, sometimes blue, and that is lichen. And the other category is, you know, bacteria. A lot of times they have a symbiotic relationship with bacteria. And the last category is animals, right? So humans, you're listening to this podcast right now, you're into mushrooms, and we have a symbiotic relationship with mushrooms. Every time we go out and pick mushrooms in the woods, we're helping them spread their spores. Every time we go and grow a mushroom, we're helping them propagate. Other animals as well have a great relationship with fungi. Leafcutter ants, if you've ever seen videos of these lines of ants carrying leaves on their back. They're actually taking those leaves back to their nest, chewing them up into a mash, and growing fungi off of it to eat. Other animals that eat fungi are squirrels, right? They harvest mushrooms and truffles to eat for the winter, and even some birds weave mycelium into their nests, and the list goes on and on. But these are just general kind of baskets that or roles that we like to label on fungi, but it's all about perspective, right? Whether it is mutualistic or parasitic, it's all about perspective.
So let's attempt to understand how much fungus there really is in our world. So some stats have found that fungi make up to 90% of the total biomass in forest soils, about 50% in agricultural soils, and the grand total of the soil on Earth, fungi represent about 25% of that biomass, which sounds like a lot. And again, most of this goes unseen. Fungi are too small to see, especially these soil dwellers that more often than not don't even produce a mushroom, and they stay subterranean doing a lot of super important work in terms of microbial balance, nutrient digestion, decomposition, and recomposition that ultimately results in creating nutrients for the surrounding environments. I mean, we would not have the lush forests and ecosystems that we have if it wasn't for soil fungi.
And although they're everywhere, they kind of go unnoticed, right? And a lot of people don't have this very close relationship with fungi, but it's crazy to note that we share over 50% of our DNA with fungi, and they really are everywhere, and they show up in the craziest places, right? They've been found underneath the ocean. Some researchers off the coast of Japan were doing some rock sampling underneath the Pacific Ocean, and they brought up 69 different types of fungi, and one of which they put on a petri plate, which grew the roots of the mushroom or the mycelium, and actually produced an actual mushroom. And they found out that this fungi was sitting in hibernation underneath the ocean for 20 million years. And so that's like finding a apple tree seed underneath the ocean for 20 million years. Not only did it produce an apple tree, but actual apples that fruited off the tree. So it's very significant, and it just shows not only how abundant fungi are on our planet, but how resilient they are as well. And they also show up outside of planet Earth. Some researchers threw a piece of lichen outside of the International Space Station and also put it in a simulated Mars environment for 1.5 years after the experiments were concluded. This lichen was still alive and thriving. So it just shows how resilient they are and puts the theory of panspermia, which is the theory that life originated outside planet Earth and maybe landed on an asteroid, it makes that theory a little more credible.
And perhaps not as cool as outer space, there are dozens of fungi that are found in Antarctica, another extreme environment where we don't see much life thriving. And the same goes for man-made, really radioactive spaces. So Chernobyl, the reactor that exploded, number 4, the first organism to be found inhabiting life in that environment once again was indeed a fungus.
And you might think, well, I'm not underneath the ocean, I'm not in outer space, I'm not in Chernobyl, and I don't really interact with fungi every day, but you're wrong. We inhale 1 to 10 spores, mushroom spores, with every breath. There's as many as 300,000 spores every day that we inhale. And there's 1,000 to 10,000 mushroom spores in every cubic meter of air at any given time, anywhere.
And if that's just the standard, imagine how many spores are in the air if you're working at a mushroom farm or anywhere where there does tend to be an abundance of mushrooms.
And that's just spores. Most people don't know that every time they're eating bread, every time they're drinking wine, eating cheese, you name it, there is yeast involved. There's fungi thriving in the foods that we enjoy, in the drinks that we consume, even in our laundry detergent or the clothes that we wear. There's fungal influence in those.
And we will get more into the nitty-gritties of that later, but before we dive too much further, we thought we'd give you some quick vocabulary. So a mushroom is a fungus, but a fungus is not necessarily a mushroom. And that's an important distinction because there are about 7 phylums in the kingdom of fungi, but only 2 of them produce mushrooms, the very macroorganisms that we see, the ones that we interact with and draw and can actually really notice. But most fungi do not produce mushrooms. Most fungi will just reproduce in their vegetative states, basically creating a spore at the tip of these cells and letting the process of life unfold there. Also, a quick note on pronunciation. You will notice that Alex and I say fungi. I used to say fungi. We have many friends in Australia who say fungi. I mean, to each their own. It does not matter. There is no right or wrong way to pronounce this word. You can even switch it up. I catch myself doing this sometimes. Back to vocabulary, we are going to quickly walk you through the life cycle of a fungus. The beginning of a fungal individual will begin with a spore. A spore is a little bit different from a seed in that it does not contain a bunch of extra nutrients to help it germinate in its environment. Fungal spores are generally just a casing with the genetics inside of it needed to reproduce, which partially explains its patience. Spores will sit on a surface, wait for years and years until it has the opportunity to sporulate, because it does not have its own sort of inventory of nutrition to just spontaneously germinate. It's very methodical about when it decides to open up that sporulate wall and attempt to establish some sort of life. The sex life of fungi is a very complicated and poorly understood subject, and we have other podcasts on this if you are interested, but for the sake of simplicity, let's just assume that most spores contain 50% of the DNA that's needed to grow more fungus. And once this spore, this fungal seed, decides to germinate, there is what's called a hyphae. That individual cell is referred to as a hyphae. Now, as we said before, not all fungi are like this. Not all fungi are filamentous. That's the word that we use to describe the cottony, like mold type of fungus. Some are yeasts. And if you look at yeast under a microscope, it's not going to look like a mesh of filaments. It looks more like bacteria, like a bunch of buds and individual cells. But fungal filaments, these are all attached. It's a network. And this is a very special property of fungus. And once it gets to that point, once it has established a network and there's a lot of little hyphal cells, then it graduates to what we call mycelium. And this is a word that many of you have probably heard these days because it's becoming more of a commonplace term, which is very exciting for us. Mycelium is a cottony network consisting of all of the cells from that individual fungus. And usually it's this white fluffy color, but that's not always true. Sometimes you can find pinks or blacks or greens. And you can think of this like the roots of the mushroom. So again, not all fungus are going to create a mushroom, but for the ones that do, the mycelium is really the bulk of its body. That's where all of the processes unfold. That's where most of its life is going to be in this mycelial form. The mushroom is very ephemeral. It's made by the fungus with an attempt to move on and reproduce. And that's why we call mushrooms fruiting bodies. That's what it is. It's a body that's designed to bear fruit, to bear spores, and create the next generation.
And as Lyra said, this is just kind of the most basic life cycle of a mushroom. And there's so many different variations of this, but if we went into every single one, this episode would be 200 hours long at very expert level. There's truffles, there's cordyceps, there's all these types of weird fungi that do a lot of different weird things. But in Myco 101, we just won't go into it. Understanding the basic mushroom life cycle is just as far as we'll go. And many mycologists believe that fungi produce more mushrooms when it's unhappy, as it's an effort to escape their current environment because there isn't enough food or conditions are no longer favorable, there's competition. So they're sending their DNA far and wide so their kids, theoretically, can have a happier, healthier, more vibrant life. And so we're kind of doing that with building rockets to colonize Mars, is that we're running out of food, we're running out of resources, the world's on fire. And we're sending rockets to space to colonize another planet. Similar to mushrooms, when they're running out of food in a log, they'll make mushrooms to shoot their spores out and try to find some more food elsewhere.
Now we want to really paint the picture of how fungi are so different from plants, because us humans went many centuries assuming that fungi were a lower version of plants, but it turns out they could not be more different. They're more like animals. And in fact, biologically speaking, you could argue to teach the science of mycology as a branch of zoology more so than you could as a branch of botany. Now, why is that? Well, there's a few very stark reasons as to why fungi are much more like animals than plants. And one of those is that they breathe in oxygen and emit CO2. Clearly, that is the inverse of what plants do. Another thing about fungus is that they are heterotrophs. So plants, what makes them so magical? They can create their own food. They photosynthesize. Mushrooms, fungus, they don't do that. They have to eat their food. They have to get their nutrition from substances around them. And this is where fungi are super interesting to me personally and many other mycologists, because unlike animals, where we have to consume our food by ingesting it, you know, we put the food inside of our bodies and all of that metabolic action happens internally, fungus do it exteriorly. So basically how a fungus eats is that it's spitting a bunch of these enzymes and metabolites, much like what you'd find in your mouth or your stomach, but it's spitting it and oozing it out of its cell walls. And then all of that chemistry is happening to the substrate around it. It's eating the woods, the organic matter, whatever it is that it happens to be surrounded by and that it can produce metabolites for. It will break down into simpler molecules and nutrients that the fungus can then reabsorb. A third thing that makes fungi so much more related to animals than plants is what they're made of. So their cell walls are made of chitin. And chitin is a biopolymer like cellulose, but it's something that you only find in the fungal and animal kingdom. Now, humans don't create chitin, but many of our other animal friends do, such as crustaceans and any insect with an exoskeleton, that super like crunchy, hard material, that's made of chitin. And that's what's in the cell walls of fungus.
To really understand fungi, we have to understand how they got here and their whole evolutionary history of how they intertwined with plants, animals, humans, you name it. So we're going to pack about 3.5 billion years in a matter of minutes. And so it might be a lot of information. So life originated on land about 3.5 billion years ago with these cyanobacteria mounds popping outside of the water. It took a couple billion years before fungi, the first fossilized fungi was ever found. So that fungi was dated to be around a billion years ago in low aquatic environments. And about 810 million years ago was the oldest terrestrial fungi ever found. And it was found in modern day Congo. 700 million years ago, we get lichen, which is the first terrestrial symbiosis of different organisms. And this is the symbiosis between cyanobacteria or algae and fungi. And the cyanobacteria or algae is photosynthesizing their food, whereas the fungi are drilling the hard, rocky terrain and trading it with the algae or cyanobacteria. Around 500 to 470 million years ago, we get the first early plants developing with mycorrhizal fungi in symbiosis. And these early plants didn't even have roots, and they relied on the mycorrhizal fungi to act as their roots. And so as the soil is being created, these early plants with the symbiosis of fungi are taking over our early earth. 430 million years ago, we get these large 30-meter tall organisms called Prototaxites. And a lot of researchers think that these are early signs of trees. And they're kind of huge structures of lichen, mostly fungi, with a photosynthetic organism involved. And it took a while, a few hundred million years, before we get fungi that are separate from the symbioses. So we see the first actual mushrooms popping up around 101 to 115 million years ago, free-forming mushrooms that you know, you've seen them, cap and stem mushrooms, and we also see cordyceps around this time, or mushrooms that are attacking insects. So they're changing their diet, they're changing their ecosystem roles, and they're popping up everywhere. Now, it took a while before we see the first evidence of human-mushroom interaction. So in 17,000 BCE, we get the Red Lady of El Mirón in modern-day Spain, and she was found with two mushroom spores wedged in her teeth, indicating that she was eating mushrooms. And over the next that many thousands of years, we see cave drawings in northern Algeria. We see some paintings and carvings in Spain. We see some mushroom objects and carvings in Egypt. In 3300 BC, we find Atsi or Utsi the Iceman, which is the oldest naturally preserved human, also called a wet mummy. And he was found with two different types of mushrooms on his body, or his mummy remains. And this is birch polypore and tinderconch. And he's using the birch polypore to clear intestinal parasites and using the tinderconch to make a kind of vegan leather, a mushroom leather, and also carry around embers of a fire so he can survive in a very cold environment in the Swiss Alps. In around 470 BC, we get the Eleusinian Mysteries in Greece, which they theorize that these people were using a kind of LSD concoction to have this sort of ritual and these mysteries over hundreds of years. In 5th century BC, Hippocrates starts talking about agaricon as the oldest recoverable written text about mushrooms for functional wellness that we can find. And over the turn of the century, in 20 to 800 AD, there's tons of books and texts coming out in China. A lot of the materia medicas that are being written and produced, they're talking about dozens of different types of mushrooms for their functional benefits. And skipping forward, going over a ton of mycology and historical events, from 1900 until present, there's been huge leapfrog advancements in mycology. A lot of modern science involved, a lot of culturing, isolating compounds, a lot of research papers coming out, bettering our understanding of what are fungi and what is going on with these mushroom things. Some notable events to point out are, in 1928, we get penicillin, which is from the penicillium mold, which has saved hundreds of millions of people's lives. 10 years later, in 1938, we get LSD, which has not only fueled the hippie movement of the 60s and started the summer of love and everything with the 60s movement, but also now is being studied for alcoholism, PTSD, and many other advancements. It wasn't until that summer of love in 1969, which fungi become separate from plants and are designated into their own kingdom, Kingdom Fungi, officially. So before then, as Lyra said earlier, they were thought as plants or vegetables, but now they are their own kingdom, which is super exciting. But because of the hippie movement in the U.S., in 1971, just a couple years later, psilocybin and psilocin-containing mushrooms or magic mushrooms are now illegal in the United States. And it took almost 40 years in 2019 for Denver, Colorado, to become the first city in the United States to decriminalize psilocybin post-prohibition era. Now, in 2018 was the birth of mushroom revival in March 2018, which is the start of who you are listening to now and how we got into mushrooms and solidified ourselves on the map as another mushroom company spreading the spores and helping mushrooms flourish in our global understanding of fungi and our love and lore of them. In 2019, Lyra had the incredible idea of launching the Mushroom Revival podcast. We linked heads, we got a mic, we recorded ourselves, and the Mushroom Revival podcast was born.
And at this time, you guys, we did not think that it would take off like it had. But not only was there interest, but there were so many things to talk about in the fungal kingdom. The more that we learned, the more opportunities for education. So it has now been over 2 years since we've started the podcast, and we're actually re-recording one of our first episodes, Mycology 101, with better quality mics, more concise information, a little more accurate information. So every week we have a topic about fungi that we have not talked about before and that we share with you guys, because it really is, to quote Peter McCoy, one of my favorite ways to describe mycology, a neglected mega science. I truly believe this because, as someone who is running a podcast, I'm constantly reading the applications for fungi, and they're massive. They're so big, and we're seeing that come into fruition today. So to end off this episode, we're going to talk about the future of fungi. So what have they been used for, and what is the potential use? Obviously, food is huge, especially in the East. So Eastern Europe and Asia, mushrooms have been a primary food source and something that people really relied on to maintain well-being, nourish themselves. And that's becoming more common in the Western world. So some ancient foods, like we talked about before, bread, beer, wine, these things could not exist without the help of fungi, most notably yeast. But now we're seeing new things come up, not just interesting culinary mushrooms, but we're seeing other food technologies such as mycoproteins. Fungi are also being used in the mental health space, so it's probably not a surprise to most of our listeners to know that psilocybin magic mushrooms are being very sincerely considered by institutions in Europe and North America as a substance that can help people who are dealing with mental illness. And then we've got the material world. And this is another sort of trending topic. We now have what's called mycoleather or fine mycelium, mushroom leather. There's all sorts of names that people are calling this material, but essentially what it is a bunch of fungal cells that have been engineered or coerced to grow in a certain way that when you process it, it gives you properties not so different from leather, and in fact, a lot of the time outperforms many of the things we know and love about leather. There's also what's called mycocomposites, and these are basically agricultural byproducts such as hemp hulls or other things that would end up in a compost heap or in the landfill that are being combined with fungus, and that fungus acts as a glue. So kind of think of it like particle board. It's a bunch of scraps of wood that people mix with glue, and then we get particle board out of it. A wonderful material. It's strong, it's durable, it's engineerable, and it's a byproduct. And that's just the tip of the iceberg with fungal materials. There's so much more to say on this, but like we said, we've got an episode on this topic, more than one, so be sure to scroll through, see what we have to offer you in terms of the material world.
One of my favorite topics of all time are fungal enzymes. So these are everywhere and they really go unnoticed and unrecognized. And I don't hear a lot of people actually talking about how significant they are in our world. The next time you do laundry and you use your laundry detergent, you probably have fungal enzymes in there to help clean your clothes. The next time you step in your car, the plastics in your car are probably produced with a fungal enzyme, and that same enzyme, itaconic acid, is actually used to produce Legos, believe it or not. Fungal enzymes show up in food, in beverages, in textiles. The next time you throw on your blue jeans, most likely those blue jeans are produced with fungal enzymes. Next time you throw on a leather jacket, yeah, fungal enzymes are showing up to produce that. Next time you're writing on a piece of paper or printing anything out, that paper is produced through fungal enzymes to help bleach and put that paper together. Even biofuel is made through fungal processing. Food, animal, and nutrition, agricultural waste, water solutions. This whole topic of mycoremediation, or using fungi to clean up toxic chemicals in our environment, from plastic to oil spills to dirty water, you name it, fungal enzymes are used on an industrial scale to clean up the most toxic substances on our earth, and we couldn't do it without the help of fungal enzymes. One really cool company to check out, they're called Novozymes, and there's a couple documentaries that feature them, but they are, I think they're the world pioneers on fungal enzymes, and they have research institutions all around the world. That's Novozymes. They're really cool and an inspiration for me.
And then we've got mycopesticides. So this is a very cool application of fungus, because generally, in our agricultural practices, we reach for chemical solutions, and these chemical solutions are non-specific and tend to attack more than one species, the problematic one and some beneficial ones, or ones that we don't necessarily want to interfere with. But mycopesticides give us an opportunity to be more selective about the organisms that we are controlling. Now, there's still so much research to be done in this field. However, there are products out there that exist that use a species of fungus that has been pretty revolutionary for maintaining healthy agricultural soils. And we've had researchers on the show that have applied the science to mosquitoes and ticks, so helping combat things like malaria and Lyme's disease micropesticides. We have a couple podcasts on this as well. Super interesting topic.
And as we are heading towards a world which relies on a lot of electricity, from new metaverses popping up to electric vehicles to you name it, we need a lot of power, and we need ways to store that power, i.e. batteries. Currently, the production of batteries is pretty toxic and has a pretty harmful toll on our environment. So there needs to be a more environmentally friendly way to produce batteries. There are some researchers around the world working to make fungal batteries, and we're actually working with a researcher now to incorporate fungi into a new battery, and we can't say much right now, but we will bring them onto the show when the research is finished and ready to share with the world. But so far, it's looking pretty phenomenal, and we're really excited about that project.
Another fun application for the future of fungi is pigments. So fungi come in all shapes and colors and sizes, and turns out their chemistries can be very beautiful too. So there is a super cool startup in Argentina called Microma, and they are fermenting species of fungi to extract a pigment. And they're working on the color red right now, and from that they're able to get orange and yellow. And eventually they're going to work with blues and greens. And this is super cool because you can grow it in a bioreactor and it doesn't require the use of bugs or other plants that might be endangered or have some sort of ecological impact when it comes to harvesting. That also means that we can steer away from petroleum-based dyes and pigments, which is just going to create a healthier world for all of us. So green chemistry, that future is so supported by the magical chemicals that fungi make. Our foods, our clothes, any of the other colored goods in our life.
With all these exciting projects and applications we could use and partner fungi to make the world a better place, we need to learn more. We have barely tapped into the wonderful world and the power of mushrooms, and so we need more resources available for people to enter this space and really learn more and share that. So we need fungi in our education systems, and we need more curriculum and ways that people can dive into learning more about fungi. And that was one of our inspirations for making this podcast in the first place, is that we thought that it was hard to access a lot of information about fungi. A lot of this research is hidden behind paywalls or scattered around the internet, and we wanted to create a platform that was available for people that we brought on the top researchers around the world of all these different projects, and we wanted to have one central place where people can access this information. But we need more institutionalized resources for people to access and study mycology. One of the most inspirational things that I've witnessed was I went to a functional mushroom conference in Nantong, China a few years ago, and one of the keynote speakers was talking about how they wanted to find more researchers for their company, and they were struggling to find people with a very robust background in mycology. And so they said, hey, there isn't a great platform for people to study mycology, so we'll make it. And they made a whole school from preschool to PhD to teach people about mycology. And that was so inspiring to see. And I think we need more institutions all around the world, from preschool to PhD, where people can really dive into mycology. I'm so excited to announce that Fungi Foundation actually created a global mycology school curriculum. So this curriculum can be taught in public schools in the US and all around the world. And I hope that's just the tip of the iceberg for all the fungi education that is to come.
And to top that off, it's important for us to mention that fungi need our protection. We are so far behind with cataloging these species and doing proper preservation. We are constantly just deforesting ecosystems and probably losing the opportunity to document, get to know, and protect many fungal species that are probably doing a lot of vital work behind the scenes. So places like fungariums are huge. We would love to see more species enter the fungarium, more education, more people talking about it, more people asking questions, and more people researching. I mean, as we've said in this podcast, there's not a lot of academic roadmaps for people who want to study mycology. But we hope that that's changing. And this podcast has been evidence that people care. People are interested. So we hope that more of you show up and the supply meets the demand for all of us curious people who either want to learn traditionally through academia, untraditionally on our own time and our own account, or through organizations such as the Fungi Foundation.
There are so many species of fungi out there, and we barely scratched the surface to discovering even a fraction of them. And so you might have the next undescribed species just sitting in your backyard. I mean, we've barely tapped into researching fungi in places like, you know, Madagascar or the Congo or the Amazon rainforest or Antarctica or underneath the ocean or, you know, even in our own backyard, we barely scratched the surface of the fungi out there. And, you know, out of 120,000 species of fungi, only 14,000 actually produce mushrooms. And out of 14,000, 50% are inedible, 25% are edible, but not so great. 20% will give you kind of a stomach ache, but, you know, won't kill you. 4% are super tasty, they're choice, they're served in restaurants and in farmers markets and grocery stores. And only about 1% will severely harm you, and only about a dozen will actually kill you. And so those statistics are now, but those will can be radically changed over the course of the next 10, 20 years when we discover more species of fungi. We just might find a species of fungi next year that can totally degrade all of our plastic and solve our plastic crisis. We may find a species that can replace styrofoam or can solve a lot of our problems that we're facing on planet Earth. So the solutions are out there. We just have to partner with nature to remember them. We need more people talking about mushrooms. We need more people researching mushrooms. We need more books, more podcasts, more companies, more researchers, more documentaries, more articles, more everything. If you're listening to this and this inspired you and you're picking up a couple mushroom fun facts, please spread the word. Like a mushroom spreading its spores, please be a mushroom and spread these spore nuggets of fun fungal information and tell your family, tell your friends, tell random person on the street, the person checking you out at the grocery store, you name it. Tell people how much you love mushrooms and how cool they are, and let's bring them into the forefront. Let's put a spotlight on them and let's make mushrooms sexy.
And thanks for sticking with us to the end of this podcast. We hope that was super helpful. You guys are so much more information. We've got a little over 125 episodes on fungus stuff, so I'm sure there's at least one of those in there that's of interest to everyone listening. And, you know, if you like this content, if it brings you value, please consider supporting Mushroom Revival. We've put so much work into providing this free education for you. We're a small business. We create mushroom products for you guys and mushroom education, and your support means the world to us. You can do that so easily by rating this podcast. And if you want to go a step further, you can review the podcast. And we actually will pick a review once a week to read on the show. And it gives you an opportunity to share your thoughts. You can tell us a joke. You can write a poem, whatever you want. We'll talk about it. We'll feature you on the show.
And one step further, we don't have a Patreon. We don't take donations. We don't even take third-party advertisements like a lot of podcasts do to keep their lights on and pay the bills. We make amazing mushroom products that we bust our butts to make sure they're incredibly potent, really high quality, and that you'll love. And so we have a whole line of functional mushroom products, from tinctures to capsules to powders, organic gummies coming soon, and a whole line of other amazing, super delicious, incredibly potent functional mushrooms for supporting your energy, focus, immune system, sense of calm. You name it, it's there at mushroomrevival.com. We're even offering a special coupon code called PODTREAT, PODTREAT. And it's a surprise. We actually change the discount code all the time. So it is an Easter egg hiding in there. You never know what you're going to get. You find out at checkout. So if you want to fill your mushroom basket with some goodies, check that out. And as always, we're sending a huge fungal hug to wherever you're listening to in the world. We have a big global audience of listeners, so big hug to everyone out there. And as always, much love, and may the spores be with you.